Welcome to St. Mark's Cathedral Conversations, a podcast featuring members of the St. Mark's Cathedral community in Seattle, Washington. These interviews feature lives of faith and adventure, service and connection. Here's our host, Michael Pereira.
I think for most people, when they come into St. Mark's, one of the first people they would meet was Chris McPeak. And I'm pretty sure most of them thought that he was actually running things there at the cathedral. And for the thousands and thousands of volunteers and staff members and clergy who work at St. Mark's, I'm pretty sure they all thought he was running the show as well. But that's not happening anymore. Chris is no longer at St. Mark's, and we're here in Christ Episcopal Church in the U District to catch up with Chris and to find out how he's been, but also to find out how this all got started for him. And with that, we want to say hello to Chris McPeak. Thank you so much.
Hi, Michael. Thank you.
So, Chris, many people have seen you at St. Mark's. They've seen you as the worship coordinator. They've seen you be the main point person for so much that goes on. But many people, myself included, don't really know how this all began for you. So can you give us a primer on how you found the Episcopal Church and how you found St. Mark's?
Yeah. So it's actually been a really long, long journey for me coming to the Episcopal Church and then even coming to St. Mark's. I was raised Presbyterian. One thing that's kind of interesting, I was baptized on Christmas Day. I've never been part of a church that baptized on Christmas Day, so I'm the only one that I've ever known that was baptized then. So I was raised Presbyterian. We went a lot when I was very little. Then we started to go only kind of on Christmas and Easter. And then it was just Easter, and then it was not at all. So from probably mid elementary school up until high school, I didn't really go to church. And then when I was in high school, we started learning about, Middle Ages, and just the Catholic Church, the Inquisition at that time. And I was kind of curious. I was like, I've never been exposed to the Catholic Church. I wonder what that's like. And at the time I was like, it's going to be in Latin. There's going to be like all of these smells and bells, and it's just going to be incredible. And so I asked my parents, this was very early in high school, to take me to a Catholic Church. It wasn't like in the Middle Ages. there's been Vatican II. It's all in English now, which was great for me. But it was the first time I was ever exposed to a church that had a higher end liturgy, one that was more formulaic week to week, and also celebrated the Eucharist every week.
Right.
And I fell in love with that. The rhythm of that. And it was from kind of that early point that I started to get kind of this idea in my head, this voice calling me toward doing something in ordained ministry.
That's remarkable to start from a Presbyterian background, to drop out of that entirely, and then to fall in love with the history and the tradition of a Roman Catholic liturgy.
Mm-hmm.
Was this all here in Seattle?
So I grew up in Snohomish. It took place in Everett in Snohomish over that time. And then I went to undergrad at SPU. I went to the Chapel of St. Ignatius over at Seattle U for church on Sundays. It's the school is run by Jesuits. The parish is run by Jesuits. Jesuits are basically Episcopalians who are Catholic. I don't know how they feel about that, but they're very liberal. They're very socially conscious. They're very accepting of a lot of different people. So that was where I was getting a lot of my deeper formation during those years was there. It also happens that was the same point that I met my wife, Amanda. She was going through, it's called RCIA, the Rite of Christian Initiation for Adults. It's basically like their catechumenate, their inquirer's process for getting baptized and then welcome at the Easter Vigil. So she was going through that at the same time that I was attending there. We met, and then that one thing led to another, and then we were married. There, I kind of fell in love with the social justice part. So in high school, I was getting the liturgical part. And then while I was in college, I was understanding more of the social justice, the outreach part of the church. And those two fit really well together in my mind, that we come together for worship every week, and then we go back out into the community to So basically you're doing church on Sunday and then you're doing church during the week.
Right.
Just carrying it out. So we went there when we were in undergrad, and then we graduated, and the Chapel of St. Ignatius isn't a fully functioning parish. They don't, except for the Easter Vigil, they don't do baptisms and funerals and those kind of things. So we graduated and we started looking for a church, mm-hmm. like an adult church.
Right.
And then it turned out, well, what we found wasn't actually nearly as accepting and welcoming of all people as the Jesuits were in the broader Catholic Church.
I see.
And so that kind of led us both to really, really question where we're at. We both love liturgy. We both love social justice and politics and just kind of that, just the theological liberalness. Mm-hmm. And so she had decided at one point that she didn't really want to go to church anymore, or at least wanted to take some time off. I didn't.
You still wanted to?
I still needed that worship experience because it fed me very deeply.
Right.
And so I started church shopping. I went to all kinds of different churches, but the last one that I went to was St. Paul's on Lower Queen Anne.
Right.
And it's an Anglo-Catholic church. So it was far higher liturgy than any Catholic church I've been to. Smells and bells every week. And I'm a huge fan of incense. So that was fantastic. And the first Sunday that I had gone was for St. Mary the Virgin in August.
Oh, wow.
So the Catholic Church has a very high Marian theology, and this was something I wasn't expecting to find outside of that.
Right.
And so I was initially very, very intrigued. I thought that was great. That was lovely. It immediately piqued my interest.
Was that your first exposure to an Episcopal church as well?
Yeah. So that was my first Episcopal church. So I didn't really know anything else besides that about the Episcopal church. Mm-hmm. But So I really enjoyed that. And then at the time, Mother Melissa Skelton was the rector there, who is now Archbishop Skelton up in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And she is just a fantastic woman, but it was also one of the first opportunities I'd ever been to see a woman presiding and a woman preaching.
Why was that important to you?
So that was important because I have always viewed all people as created in the image of God. I know there's some theology, it's particularly in the Catholic and Orthodox Church, about why only males are allowed to be priests, but it never made sense to me, partially because of where my reading of the Bible is coming in and where my theology is fitting. I look at the Bible and there are such strong and powerful women that are following Jesus, perhaps more faithfully than a lot of the men that are, and to cut off an entire gender from ministry, just it didn't fit with my worldview.
Right.
So initially I got really excited because I was like, I think my wife's gonna like this. And it'd been like maybe 6 months or something. She hadn't gone to church, and maybe even longer than that, for quite some time, and I missed going to church with her. It was one of the things we did together. So I was really excited that one, there's this powerful woman in ministry, and it's something I hadn't seen before, and I liked that. But I was also like, I think my wife might really like this. I think she might look at Mother Melissa and see like some of those ideals that we had always held together. So she did. She agreed to come and loved it. And so we both did. So we started going there really regularly. We went through, after a couple years, we went through the inquirer's class there. Mm-hmm. We were received into the Episcopal Church, at St. Mark's Cathedral. That was actually, one of my first experiences at the cathedral.
Was that a cathedral day?
It was cathedral day. Yeah. The only before that, I had gone to Compline, I think like twice.
Of course.
Which most people have at some point, which is a great ministry, and it's a great starting point for anyone interested in the church.
Definitely.
But yeah, the first time I experienced like a full-on liturgy was Cathedral Day, and it's a very impressive liturgy.
Yeah, I mean, all the bells and whistles, which you really enjoy as part of service.
Yeah, so there's a lot of banners and just sitting there watching the bishop kind of go around and laying his hands on everyone, and the thing I really remember is that when Mother Melissa presented us to the bishop, he presented Amanda, my wife, first, and then me. She said that we were there for confirmation, and Amanda was like, "No, I've already been confirmed. This is reception." And then she and the bishop had like a little conversation, and I'm like standing behind them watching this go down, and it was just wonderful because it was like a real moment happening in a very liturgical sense, but it was a people interaction, which was very exciting to see, and something that's actually carried over into how I've done ministry, how I've viewed ministry, and some of my favorite experiences in liturgy.
Bishop Rickle does talk about that a lot, the experience of blessing dozens upon dozens upon dozens of people at Cathedral Day. And he's often wished that there was a way to enjoy that interaction, the one-on-one interaction of the laying of hands, while still keeping things moving along, obviously. Yeah. And to have that moment with Amanda where she, you know, offered the correction of how she started this, of where she was in the process, and then for him to engage her with that speaks to a really good moment of connection.
Yeah, he's an absolutely excellent leader. He's just incredibly pastoral, and one of the things that I've always appreciated is his ability to have those kind of personal connections, and they don't have to be particularly long. It can just be like a short little conversation in the middle of a liturgy, which, yeah, it humanizes people.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Where did the idea of the priesthood come from?
So, like I said, that kind of started when I was first exposed to church, or at least a higher liturgy church in high school. And it kind of was planted in my head when I was in high school and before I met my wife. I thought about becoming a Catholic priest. But I also felt a calling to be married as well. So much so that it was probably my first year of undergrad. I wrote a letter to the Archbishop of Seattle and wanted to talk to him about why priests were not allowed to marry, given the historical and biblical grounds. Mm-hmm. There's really no prohibition against it. So I was probably very precocious, but he invited me for an interview to talk.
Very nice.
So I went in and talked to him and laid it all out, and he was very clear that this was never going to happen. and I was kind of crushed because it was something that I felt a very strong calling toward, I didn't really understand at the time in thinking about it how, because I believe both were very coming very directly from God, and that if both of these callings were coming from God, how one could be wrong and one could be right. So that's kind of where it was started and got nurtured. And then we started going to an Episcopal church, and all of a sudden it became a possibility again. The idea of being married and being a priest. And so that idea just kind of grew, but I kind of kept it in the back of my mind. Like I said, we hadn't grown up particularly religious. I don't know that my family was too particularly keen on me becoming a priest. I think there was a lot of not understanding how like the church worked.
Yeah.
And I think there was an idea that like if you become a priest, like you'll be impoverished. You'll never be able to support yourself.
Of course.
And so I kind of put it in the back of my mind.
Right.
And so from after undergrad, my wife went to pharmacy school, so I went to physical therapy school. I got a doctorate in physical therapy from the UW, and then went into practice for a few years. All the while, just this kind of thought started to gnaw more at me as I went along. And I remember at one point having a conversation with Mother Melissa and kind of telling her all this, and like that I felt called toward some kind of ministry. But at the time I couldn't really necessarily articulate that it was supposed to be the priesthood.
Of course.
I was like, maybe I should be a chaplain. Maybe I should be a priest. Maybe I need to go into like academia and teach theology. And so her recommendation was to try going to seminary, take some classes, see how they fit, and kind of use that as like a pre-discernment time. And so I did. I applied to the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology, where she had been teaching as a homiletics professor, class like once every other year, and started going there. And I loved it instantly. I absolutely loved all of the theological education, all of that. But one of the things that really stuck out to my head during that process was when I was having my acceptance interview, I was kind of out of cycle with the way they were doing interviews. So I had my interview with the president of the school.
Oh, wow. So you've made a case to the Archbishop of the Diocese of Seattle, and you presented yourself to the president of the School of Theology and Psychology.
Yes.
Yep. No half measures with you.
No, apparently not. I loved him. He was such a pastoral man. But one of the things he told me is that he's also been a spiritual director for a very long time. Mm. And one of the things that he often recommends to people when they feel they have a calling toward the priesthood or toward ministry, is that you just kind of keep pushing it away. You push it to the back of your head. You keep kind of running from it for as long as you possibly can. And then if it finally kind of breaks you and you can't get away from it, then you know that that's a real calling and that's something to pursue.
Did that describe you?
Yeah, it did. I think his description fit me kind of perfectly. The possibility of priesthood and ministry was always something that was in my head, but it wasn't something I was able to fully embrace yet. I don't know, maybe I needed to test it a little bit more.
Right.
I come from a science background. I have biology undergrad and then physical therapy. And so I think at least part of my psyche was saying, like, this is like a hypothesis that you have to test.
Wow.
Like, you have to test this and see if this is actually going to pan out. If this is actually what you think it is. His description fit really well, and so I was really excited to start seminary and to find out that everything actually fit even better than I thought it would.
It's a really good feeling when your background and your own inclinations complement where this is coming from. The two are not at odds at all.
No, and to take a sidebar, like, that's one of the things that I've actually found in the Episcopal Church that I've really appreciated is this connection between kind of reason and theology. Hmm. It comes back to the idea of the three-legged stool, that our theology and our teachings are based on scripture, tradition, and reason. And one of the things that I think is the most important to me of the Episcopal Church is we don't leave our reason behind. We are traditionally very thinking people, and that fit me really well, because I was able to take kind of my science background and then what I was learning in theology, and actually they fit together really well and really influenced me in fascinating ways.
How did St. Mark's eventually come up on your radar?
In the third year of the program, you did an internship or a field ed at a parish. And this was a little while after Mother Melissa had become Bishop Melissa in Diocese of New Westminster. St. Paul's had just gotten a new rector. I think it was within 6 months of when I was supposed to start my internship. I talked to her. She was great about it, but she's like, you know, I'm new here. I really can't take an intern, which made complete sense to me. I was like, of course you need to get to know this place before you take on a student.
Yes,
like,
absolutely.
Yeah, it made complete sense. So I talked to one of my professors at school, and he was like, you know, maybe you should talk to the cathedral. See if nothing else, maybe they can point you in a direction for a church that might be able to take on an intern. So I set up an appointment with Dean Thomason, and we sat in his office and we talked, and he, one of the things he told me was that they could do an intern, but that he never wanted to act kind of unilaterally about these things. He advised me to talk to Nancy Martin, who was one of the canons there a few years ago, and then a couple other people on staff. And I talked to her, about doing an internship and seeing if that was something that she'd be able to support Dean Thomason in. And then as I was leaving, I met Malcolm McLaurin on the way out, and it was during the summer, and there was a table outside of the bookstore, and we sat at the table, and we talked about liturgy and like some books that we were reading, and the Blue Angels were flying overhead, and
if there was ever a sign,
I know it was a great day, and so St. Mark's agreed to take me on. As an intern. So I served a year at St. Mark's in an internship, kind of doing, I think, a lot of things that I had always wanted to do. Like I was able to volunteer and teach with the Tuesday Bible study. I was able to preach some at the midweek Eucharist, able to volunteer for and teach with some of the confirmation and inquirers classes. All the while, I was getting these weekly mentorship meetings with Steve and Nancy, mm-hmm. Which was invaluable. They have so much experience and wealth of knowledge.
How did it come about that you became, for a while, the worship director?
So after my internship, I still had a year left of school. And it was that fall that Becky, who had been the liturgist, left to pursue another job. And they basically took her position mm-hmm. and split it into one that does a lot of the leaflets and some more of the day-to-day things, and then one that was there mostly on Sunday mornings, kind of getting everyone in line. And so Greg Block was doing the leaflets at the time, so he naturally took that over. And I sat down with Steve, and we talked about that I have this great love of liturgy. Like, if there's an opportunity to help in any way, I'd be happy to do that. I'd be ecstatic to do that. Mm-hmm. So I was hired to be the worship coordinator, that Sunday morning piece.
And give us an overview of what being the worship coordinator was like and what you had to do.
There's a lot of little things that I would say that was the little things were the biggest thing that I did. There was getting together presiders' books, getting readings printed for the weekend, making sure the gospel book was all prepped for the deacon, getting out microphones, as well as making sure that the services were going to be fully staffed, and then making sure that all of the ministers were actually there on Sunday morning, so that the services could go off basically with a hitch. Then during the services, there were also things, if there were mic issues, as you're familiar with, or just anything that goes wrong in the middle of the service. If someone forgets to bring their book and they're sitting up on the altar to make sure that they have that before they need it at some point in the service. And then also just coordinating a lot with the different ministry groups that are involved on a Sunday morning. So ushers, chalice bearers, readers, altar guild. All of those different groups.
Well, you wanted liturgy, you got liturgy.
Yeah, and it was such an incredibly formational experience being able to do that. It put me so in touch with how the liturgy works on a very practical level. You can know a lot about the Book of Common Prayer. You can read the Book of Common Prayer, but it's meant to be in action, and that's what the liturgies are all about.
Action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so liturgy roughly translates to the work of the people, mm-hmm. And I have always felt that the church is at its strongest when the people are working together for a common cause, and that's one of the things that they're able to do with the liturgy. They're united for a common purpose.
One of the biggest events that St. Mark's has hosted in the recent past was the visit from Presiding Bishop Michael Curry, mm-hmm. and you were worship director.
I was.
What was that mm-hmm. experience like?
It was a bit stressful leading up to it. I remember I had initially signed up to start the College of Congregational Development, and I was going to do one of their week long class periods, and it was going to be during that week. And when I found out the presiding bishop was coming and what it was going to take, I was like, I think I will hold off on CCD and come revisit this again, maybe in the fall, just because I knew it was going to take a lot of time, not only day of, but just like getting everything prepped.
Absolutely.
But it was really one of the best experiences, just because there was so much energy in the cathedral one, because it was absolutely packed, and the presiding bishop just exudes energy in absolutely everything he does. But it was also a really fun time because I also got to play a little bit of host. When Bishop Rickle and Bishop Curry got there, Bishop Rickle was like, can you take him here, XYZ? And then afterward, one of my jobs was that I was to get him to an office because he was going to be doing an interview for the BBC. So they get invested, and then he comes with like his little entourage, and I'm like showing him the way, like through the maze of the parish offices to find a place to sit. And the thing I will always remember is he was just the kindest man I have ever met. He is as kind and wonderful as you would ever think he is from hearing him speak one-on-one, which really reassured me in the church. He was absolutely incredible. We brought him some water. My wife was with me, and he was like, do you guys want to stay? Do you want to sit down while I do this interview? Like, you don't have to go. By this point, it was like 9:30 at night. And we're like, well, it's okay. We'll leave you to it. And like, he gave us big hugs on the way out. And like, he was just so welcoming and so happy. And just so very gracious.
What are your next steps? So you've talked about the work you've done at St. Mark's. You talked about why the call to priesthood never went away. You gave it time, you tried other things, but it was always there. Mm-hmm. And now that you've taken this next step away from St. Mark's, what does that future look like for you?
So I just to back up just a little bit, my time at St. Mark's was so incredibly formative for me. It took kind of that call that was in my head, that was coming from God, and really helped me to nurture it and to be able to articulate it and to grow in it and fill in my place as a minister in the church. The next step for me is that I'm serving as an intern at Christ Episcopal Church in the U District. I'll be here for a year. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of little things that I'm going to get to do again, the little things, but it's different little things. It's very pastoral things. It's teaching. Right now I'm teaching an adult ed class on the six clobber passages that are the passages from the Bible that have historically been used to kind of beat down LGBT persons and kind of ostracize them from the church. So I'm teaching that right now. I'm having opportunities to preach, and much to my delight, I'm able to help plan liturgies. We've actually written a few new liturgies for services that we'll be doing this fall. At the end of the month, there's going to be it's called a Red Mass. It's a blessing of the Academy. Traditionally, it's been done in lawyers in the UK, and it's traveled to the United States. But it's going to be welcoming in professors and students and blessing them as they go about their work of education for the coming year. And then we also have a very St. Francis themed St. Francis Day that I'm very excited about. And then we're doing kind of a spooky All Souls service on Halloween, because this community gets very into the holiday.
So in some way, this is a dream come true for you. You fell in love with the history and the practice of liturgy all the way back in high school. Mm-hmm. That was what got this ball rolling. And through all the places you visited and all the things you've done, you're at a place now where, like you said, you can help create liturgies that are full of action. They're full of people engaging within the community and without the community mm-hmm. as well. Inviting people from UW who are starting on this process, inviting people who would celebrate Halloween, for example, mm-hmm. to be a part of this as well.
Yeah, and so that the Halloween one, I'm particularly excited to see how it plays out, just because I think it's going to draw in a lot of people who wouldn't normally step into a church. I think there'll be people who are out for Halloween, and we'll see an open church door with a sign inviting them in, and they'll come in for a little while and see what's going on. And I, that's that right there is one of the things I love about Episcopal evangelism. You're not really going to ever find Episcopalians standing on street corners telling people that they need to repent or say some prayer to become magically Christian and to save them. Like, that's not going to happen. That's just not who Episcopalians are. We will invite you into our worship, and from there we hope that you'll see what we believe and see how that resonates and is practiced in our lives.
Which is what liturgy is.
Yep.
How it works and what it does for us.
Yeah, one thing that I've never been able to shake since I was in seminary was we read one book, and there was some kind of citation in it that only 5% of our daily actions are conscious. So 95% of everything you do is just kind of automatic. But those automatic processes are influenced by what you do on a regular basis. So when you go to church, mm-hmm. it's very Eucharistic, like the way our liturgy is set up. So like the body of the people are gathered. We listen to scriptures, we sing songs, we share in a meal, we are blessed, and then we are broken and shared to go back out into the world. And I think that the rhythm of that, the liturgy of that, helps shape us to be more Christ-like as we go into the world, especially with those kind of automatic things that we're not even thinking about, just kind of those knee-jerk reactions that we might do.
This is, in a way, a culmination and an affirmation that this was something you were always going to be a part of. This was something that was always going to be a part of you, too.
Yes. Yeah, I agree fully. And one of the real blessings of going through the discernment and postulant process, at least the way this diocese does it, and I'm so thankful for the people who put together the curriculum and all that we do in preparation for the priesthood here, because it's not like this everywhere. But they have you sit in conversation with other people. You sit in a lot of conversations with other people. But the thing that's great is you have those in all of those conversations, you have people reflecting things back at you. So like, while I had this call in the back of my head, this was another way I was able to test it. Like, do other people see it? Like, when we have our conversations, like, are they able to be like, yeah, this makes sense to me too. I think that you're called as well. And it's, the great thing is then you know you're not going it alone. You're always going through it with other people.
Because it can be scary.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, it's very scary. I remember when I got the letter from the bishop telling me that I was admitted as a postulant, I was first really excited, and then going through the whole thing, like just the weight kind of settles upon you. Right. It's like, wow, like there's a lot to do, and this is also a really big step in the journey.
But you've never... I mean, I'm sure as intimidating as it did seem at a point, this is not something you've ever seriously doubted, ever questioned, that are you the right person for this? Or has that moment come up?
No, which is surprising because I second guess absolutely everything. but it's one of the two things so far in my life that I have not doubted. My call to the priesthood is one, and then... getting married to my wife is the other one.
Of course.
Those are the two things that I have not doubted at all. They felt like they were coming from a place that was so much bigger than I am. Mm-hmm. And that to not engage with that would be a disappointment to myself and to the world and to God.
Just as we start to wrap this up, I just have a couple of more questions. And mm-hmm. one of the things you mentioned, that certainty of one, starting out on this journey, and two, marrying Amanda. You said your first time in St. Mark's proper was Cathedral Day when you were both received. Do you remember what your impressions were of the building, of the cathedral, being there at that time?
The first thing is that it's a huge building. It's also very domineering because it's less so now because the limestone tiles are lighter. But before it was quite dark, and it was huge. And so that's the one thing I remember. And then the other piece is stepping inside. I remember feeling really, really small, and I loved it. I felt like it somehow connected me to God in a different way than you normally do on a daily basis. It's like stepping inside of a huge space, you realize how small you are in the world. Mm. As opposed to just like when I go home to my 800 square foot apartment, like I'm much bigger in that space than I am in the cathedral. One of the things that, and I didn't really reflect on this until after I'd left that position, was that whenever I would come to the cathedral, at least probably like 97% of the time, I would always enter the offices through the nave. And just the aspect of coming in and being greeted by the font and then the vastness of the church reminded me why I was there every time. Even if it was some kind of more mundane like office task that I was actually there to do, it was for this much bigger purpose.
We always finish by asking our guests if there was a moment in their time at St. Mark's, even a series of moments, that stays with them, a memory or a story that you like to go back to remind yourself this is why it mattered.
Last Christmas Eve was also the fourth Sunday of Advent. We had six services in one day. It was insane. It snowed. My family does a big thing on Christmas Eve. We weren't able to do any of that because we were at church all day. But the thing that shocked me was that I think it was the services at 11 o'clock at night. It's been snowing. I was like, no one's coming to this. No one's going to be here. Like, hopefully they came earlier and like they've done their church piece and now they're at home lovingly watching the snow. But it was packed. There were a ton of people there, and one of the things that will always stick with me is that all of the sacrifices that we make are for the greater good of the community, the greater good of the church, and to be a welcoming and hospitable presence to absolutely anyone that wants to come visit, even if it's at 11 o'clock on Christmas Eve with a ton of snow outside.
I perfectly remember that day because it was Advent 4 plus Christmas Eve. You and I were serving in our respective capacities. Mm-hmm. So I started at 8:30 a.m. and I'm sure you were there much earlier. Mm-hmm. And the usual two morning services plus the afternoon Christmas Eve service plus the early evening Christmas service plus the 11 p.m. Christmas service. Mm-hmm. And then back there a few hours later for Christmas Day.
Yes, for the next day.
And yet, people still came.
Yeah, and a lot of people came. Yeah. And that's one thing that's really awesome about being the cathedral church is you get a lot of people for some of those bigger holidays that they may never come to church throughout the rest of the year. Like when I was a kid, we came on Christmas and Easter. Christmas and Easter are the two biggies, and it's absolutely packed. But much like the presiding bishop Evensong, it's a great opportunity to welcome people.
Chris McPeak, thank you so much for taking us on such an amazing journey of how this started for you, how so many things changed, but you found one of the highest callings that continues to speak to you and influence you throughout your time at St. Mark's, which was amazing, and now towards the future. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. Our music was performed by Michael Kleinschmidt on the Flintrop organ at St. Mark's. Michael Pereira and Andrew Himes produced the podcast, and we hope you'll visit stmarks.org. So long.